I don't know how many of you knew her, but back in 1933, for what occasion, I don't know, maybe you know, Ernest, King, why my mother would write a paper on Butler Township in 1933? Anyway, she did.
She was interested in all of that.
But it seems that Jonathan Hart came from Washington County, New York in 1835, as we have up here, and he purchased the first piece of land in Butler Township. That was on July 25th. He did not live here then. He just purchased the land. That was the first purchase. And then I'll read this that my mother has written about Butler Township. Butler Township, which for years was a part of Girard Township, is a rolling, can you all hear? Is a rolling tract of land and was once heavily covered with timber, excepting in the southeast corner where there are about 300 acres of oak opening. Quaker Lake, which is over here, covered about 150 acres, and the rest of the township was rather marshy. Because of this condition, this township was not invaded by settlers for 5 or 6 years after the adjoining townships were settled. The first land was purchased in 1835 by Jonathan Hart, but he did not come to live into the township until the spring of 36. The first settler was Caleb Wilcox in 1836, who settled on Section 2. That would be over here. A few days later, Jacob Shook, Jr. and Robert Wood settled on Section 25, 26, and 27. Solander Rossman settled upon Section 11 and 12. Henry Lampman settled on 80 acres on Section 14. Mr. Wood later sold out to John Wisner and S.L. Wilmer and went further west. Jacob Shook, Jr. at one time owned 800 acres, and from his name, Shook's Prairie gained its name. That's off in this corner of the township. Jacob Shook, Sr., who later lived with him, met with a painful death by the accidental discharge of his rifle, which he had set for a deer. This was the first death in the township. That was in 1837. George Lockwood of New York came to our township this same year, 1836, and bought 160 acres from Mr. Wood. He engaged to pay for it with some money and the rest in 2 years of farm labor. The same year, he built the first stone house in the township upon it. That would be in Shook's Prairie. After finishing his contract to pay for his farm, he married Miss Louisa Rice in 1839, a second wedding in the township. The story of Henry Lampman is rather interesting. He was born in New York in 1831. When he was 21, he left home, went up the Hudson River, later down the Erie Canal to Buffalo. From there, on a steamer, he came to Detroit. From Detroit, he walked to Kalamazoo and worked at a lumber camp that winter. In the spring, he went to Washtenaw County and worked at brick making for a year and also married while there. Following spring, he went to Chicago, which then contained but 3 frame houses. Can you imagine Chicago? And he there made the brick for the first brick house ever erected in Chicago. Elder David Lindsay settled on Section 14 and 15 in the spring of 1837. His is another interesting story. A picture of his home in this old book, and the picture is over there on that easel. Picture of his home in this old book shows the house that Mr. Merriman was, is now living in. But remember, this was 1933. And the little cemetery north of it. Now, this would be the one opposite the Butler Speedway. I don't know if any of you know the Butler Speedway. I'm looking around here. The barns have changed from then. He purchased 160 acres here, made a small clearing, and erected a log house first. Before leaving New York, he had been a preacher and continued this work here. He preached at the first funeral sermon, married the first couple, was the first justice of the peace, and was the first supervisor of Butler. He really got around, didn't he? The first town meeting was held at his home with 14 voters. He had the first store in Butler. In those days, he was a Whig, and probably from this came the name of Whig Center. One of his daughters, Minerva, married Charles Bowers. Charles Bowers went into service during the Civil War and was in Sherman's March to the Sea. Sick and exhausted, he fell out of the ranks. For 11 years, his family knew nothing of his faith. Finally, they heard from the wife of a Confederate soldier that she had found him and cared for him until he died. He left a small son, Don Juan Bowers, who is remembered by many today. There is the picture of another Butler homestead in that old book, and that is the one we call the Burbank Place on the east side of the road. That's another picture over there, and it's right up this road a half a mile. The barns are the same as now, but the house has been improved since then. Dwight L. Burbank, father of the Frank Burbank we all knew, built this home years after the old log house had served their first use as a home. He bought 80 acres of what was called wild land in Butler and cleared it. Dwight married Julia A., daughter of William Rogers, another old settler in Butler. He also was in the Civil War and in Sherman's March to the Sea. He was wounded only in the arm. I had a letter from Dwight Burbank's granddaughter, Donna, who lives in New Mexico, and they have a certificate that the farm was purchased in 1852, and then for the first 40 acres they paid $160, bought it from the state of Michigan. In 1865, the township board called a meeting to vote for a special tax to be paid as bounties to volunteers who would enlist and be a credit to Butler. My father, Bradley O'Moore, had enlisted before this and served 3 years. After his discharge, he went to his people in New York, rested a year, then came back here to Butler to his work of clearing the timber from his farm, married, and made his home here. Charles Wisner was the first teacher, and that was at Tewksbury, I think. Merrill Moorhouse built the first frame house. Alvin Bowen built the first brick house in Tewksbury. In 1849, the first sawmill was built by Nathaniel Knowles. And since then, it's called Knowles Mill. That was on Hog Creek over here. Yeah. In 58, Lyman Calkins built the first saw and grist mill in Herrickville. In 48, Abraham Lampman settled in the south part of the township with his sons Lumen, Epinetus, and Ambrose. At a town meeting in 1844, they voted to pay $3 for every wolf's head and ears in Tyron, and $1.50 for every half-grown wolf caught by any inhabitant. They voted to raise $9 to pay the bounties for that year. I guess they didn't expect to catch one. The first schoolhouse was built in Tewksbury in 1838. It was a stone schoolhouse. Two or three more schoolhouses were built soon after of logs, but the rest were not built until after the war. Butler Masonic Lodge was organized in 1855, and the meetings were first held over Gardner Herrick's store in Herrickville. That'd be over in the northeast corner of the county. Gardner Herrick was their first worshipful master. In 1860, Ambrose Lampman was elected master and seems to have served almost continually for 20 years or more. In 1877, in connection with Butler Grange, they purchased the lot in the center of the township. Now, that would be on the corner, a half mile north of here. And built a hall. The upper hall was owned by the Masons, the lower half by the Grangers. Butler Grange was organized in 73. They held meetings in the town hall, just a couple doors down here, first until the joint Masonic Grange Hall was completed a little farther north. The first religious society was the Methodists, holding their meetings in the log house, then the schoolhouse at Tewksbury. In 1854, the Baptists erected a church in Dayburg, the first one in the township. That's off in this direction. A free will Baptist society organized in Butler Center in 1858. And in 67, the present society was organized at Whig Center. The present, that would be in 1933. I guess. Among the members of that society, we see the names of William Vickery, Stuart Wilcox, Thomas and William Rossman, Matt Lucas, Nathan Haight, Polly Rossman, Melissa Van Heesen, names which are familiar to some of us. As I said at first, this book was, she wrote at the top that she had gotten this from a book published in 1879 by her father, B. O'Moore. Neither Homer nor I know anything about that book, but this book was printed in 1879. Many changes have occurred since then, but that's another story. Much more could be told, but time does not permit. Lula Moore Wilkinson, February 17, 1933. Then there are a couple amplifications of her story that this Jacob Shook, from whom Shook's Brewery was named, for many years he was one of the most prominent men in Butler, and as highway commissioner, assessor, supervisor, and county judge, served in the county. George Lockwood, that I mentioned earlier, built the first stone dwelling house in the township in 36. He married Louisa Rice, theirs being the second marriage in Butler Township. Then David Lindsay, that we mentioned, Elder David Lindsay, whose picture's up there, had the first store, which was at Wick Center. Then in 1838, that's 2 years after, 3 years after the first land purchase, the Senate and House of Representatives of the State of Michigan, by an act approved March 6, 1838, erected Butler from Girard Township. That's when Butler became a township. At the time the township was organized, its territory contained a voting population of about 20 voters. The majority of them were from Butler in Wayne County, New York. And at a preliminary meeting, they decided by ballot to name the next township, the new township, Butler, in remembrance of their old home in the latter state. Then they had election of officers on April 2nd. Then on April 6, 1846, it was voted and carried to raise 50 cents per head, H-E-D-D, for every child over 4 and under 18 years of age in the township of Butler. In 1865, they had a meeting to discuss the raising of bounties for volunteers. Now, let's see if it was. Oh, in the organization of the Grange, it's Butler, it was Butler Grange number 88, Patrons of Husbandry. Then Emmett Locke recently, I guess this year, talked with Marie Daniels, and they combined in making a report on some of the southern part of the township. There were at one time two post offices, one at Faxon and one here at South Butler. The Faxon post office was on the northwest corner of Bidwell and Quincy Grange Roads. The postmistress was Mrs. Ambrose David, or Jenny Faxon. There was a blacksmith shop as well over here where the Knowles Mill was. The mill race and a portion of the dam are still visible, some of them. It says there was a wagon trail that originated a half mile west of the Faxon post office on the Charlie Locke farm, the father of Emmett Locke, and followed the wooded high ground across a small creek on the Locke farm, where remains of the stone crossing are visible today, through the Speaker property, crossing Dean Road, the Ferguson 40, passing three early settlers' homes on the trail, and west through Girard Township and into Girard for supplies. And in 1848, a half-acre site was conveyed to the First Baptist Church of Butler for a meeting house and burial ground, which is would be west of the present church that's there. The original church became inadequate and a quarter acre of land was purchased on the east. And the present day Burke Baptist Church was built on that site in 1898. Originally, the Dayburg burial ground was adjacent to the church, but due to the high water level in 1862, this burial ground or cemetery was moved 1/2 mile north. Then he mentions that there was a blacksmith shop on the Tom Dean Hill. Now, this would be on the Girard Road, across from where Napier, somewhere in the vicinity of where Napier's lived now.
That's where they do.
What?
It was right in their dooryard on the south side.
Oh, good. Okay, now that's some of the early background of the township. And we have some people here who know a lot more about the present day. And so I think we'll start right down. Oh, I did want to mention there. I'm going to give it to you and then I don't. This church, this was a church originally, was built in 1893. Then in January of 1910, the land with the church parsonage next door was sold to Bradley O. Moore, because the preachers, the ministers who were serving this church were also serving Herricksville and Clarendon, and they wanted a parsonage more centrally located. So they took the money and bought a parsonage in Herricksville, and all the records that went to that new parsonage. So we don't really know too much about the earlier part of this church life here. And in June of July of 1948, the deed was signed to transfer this church property to Butler Township Board to be used as a community hall. Okay.
June, I wonder if you know what happened to the name that was on this church. It said South Butler Methodist Church.
I think it was up on my folks' farm at one time, but I don't know where it is.
It is now at Cohen's in Jackson. The Eating House in Jackson, they have this great big wooden structure on the stairway that is leading to the antiques downstairs. And it's a South Butler Methodist Church. I don't know if it was sold or if somebody just picked it up or what happened. But there, I walked in there one day and there it is.
What place in Jackson again?
Cohen's. Bill Cohen's. It's a steakhouse, I guess, or something.
The township never sold it while I was there.
Well, you will find it there, and I'd like somebody to go and look at it.
Well, would you like to start out, Leona, and tell us you are from the Quick Center area over there?
That's right. Well, I just wanted to add a little bit more. Now, that she was talking about South Butler and over this way. There was also a post office in what was Herricksville, what is now North Butler. You probably know it as North Butler. There was also a post office, a blacksmith shop, and as they said, the hall was moved down there, the Masonic Hall at one time, you know. And there was, this was really a big place. I can just barely remember it, but it was a big place. It had three stores. It had a doctor's office. Help me out, Ernie. What else?
Well, they had a blacksmith shop, later two garages.
There was an Eagle Hall. There was
a big church
and a school. But I mean, at one time, Herricksville was larger than South Butler.
I think one time we had 1,400 population here in Butler Township.
And I just brought the abstract and title from the Rossman Estate, just to brief my mind a little bit. I thought my aunt was going to be here, Iva Smith, and she could have helped us out a lot more because she could have remembered a lot of these things. But I have the title here where Rossmans purchased the Rossman Farm in 1837. And I have it all, the 200 acres now is all brought right up to date. But it started out in 1837. And at that time, they paid $100 for it, I think, for that. And at that time, it went into heirship property and, you know, divided here and there. Jeff gave some to his family, and William, my great-grandfather, and it was gradually given to different ones and naturally sold. Well, when Jim and I took it over, we bought back the original 200 acres, and we have all of it now just the way it was when it was taken up in 1937 and all brought up to date. 1837.
Now, this report says that there was that this elder David Lindsay built the first store in Whig Center, the first store in the township. Does anybody remember seeing that store there? Has that been gone for many, many years?
That's been gone many years. That was gone before I...
I don't remember seeing it yet.
Where is Wake Center? I've heard it referred to.
It's right on the corner of Litchfield Road and 555.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Wick Center School. And that Wick Center School, the property was sold by the Rossman family for the Wick Center School. And the cemetery, the Wick Center Cemetery around the corner, I understand that my ancestors back, I don't know just which one of them, wanted to give it to the to Butler Township, or to, yes, the Butler Township. But it would not be legal unless they paid for it. So they gave him 50 cents to make it legal.
Good deal.
Good deal.
Okay. Do you have anything more?
Not right now that I can think of. Maybe if anybody wants to ask me anything about it, I could tell them.
Okay. Ernest, what have you got up your sleeve over there?
Well, I'll have to talk to my relation, I guess. My granddad, or great-grandfather, had a couple 300 acres. He came to New York State, over in corner of 60 and 99. There's a schoolhouse there, and he had 300 acres. Well, he had two boys that I know of, and probably some girls. But one boy, Gilbert, was always anxious. That's my granddad's brother. He was always like the monkey of machinery. So he came over here and bought this place north of, oh, can't think of his name now, but right north of the creek on the west side on this road up here. And he put up a foundry, iron ore foundry. And they drawed it in there, and of course they had to draw the coal and coke from Quincy. And after a few years, the thing got, it was wood, you know, all but the chimney that they melted the iron in. The whole thing got a fire, and there's just a little milk house up there now. It's left of the brick from that furnace. And that's one corner. My granddad, I haven't looked up too good, but he went to Iowa and bought 160 acres back in the 1870s, I judge. And he paid for it, built a house, built a barn. 2 or 3 years, the government come along and said, you don't have a title. He bought it of a land shark or a bank or something. And so they chased him out, and he took two covered wagons and his four or five kids, and his mother-in-law was kind of retired, I guess. He fell in a fireplace with a baby years before, and my grandfather and grandmother took care of her the rest of her life. But he brought that whole batch down to where I live, 40 acres there. And it was 4 acres cleared. And Dad said they went to work and they drawed those maple logs 50 feet long, 4 foot in diameter, into piles and burnt them. And one of the prices he paid for 40, there was two children buried right in the corner, right there to that corner of Windorf and in my northeast corner.
Oh, yeah.
And part of the price, he was to take those children up and put them in a regular cemetery. And that was most I know about it. But the whole country has changed. Now, was Judd Moore any relation to your Moores? He owned the whole corner, and that's where Moore were. Judd
Jud.
Moore.
J-U-D?
Yes.
I wondered where
he was. He was William Dean's wife's mother, father and mother, and they lived where Harry Schaefer place is. But they had that 40, West 40, that I have, and they built the school there, and deeded the land of the school, let's say, and then they built the school. Originally, it was over on the Herricksville Road, a mile north. I don't know, that's about all I know about the corners. Of course, there was a sawmill on this 40 there at the west side on Dean Road. and there's been a dozen places around us. It's whole families lived when we came there, and there isn't even a burdock left. Houses are moved and the ground plowed.
And now, how long have you been there?
Can't tell. 1918, I guess, since I was there.
Excuse me. Never mind.
That's okay. I don't know. There's been, as you say, in your towns here, there's been a lot of change. We had the post office here, and your dad was, they had a nice store. They had the schoolhouse, and they had the Grange Hall, and the Mason Hall, and the church. And back when we had the schools, we knew all the neighbors. We got together. Our district, lots of times, once a month, anyhow, all winter. And it's changed the country completely since they consolidated. Yeah,
there were seven school districts.
Yes.
And this was number seven next door here.
They knew everybody, and they'd get together and had their school meeting, or not necessarily meetings, but kid programs and things, and so much better. I was supervisor, I don't know when, 37 or somewhere. And I knew every man, woman, and baby in this township. Now I go to next door, and people in Detroit. Right on the back end of my farm, Detroit. And right across up the hill is another Detroit.
I'm from Detroit.
You are too. You didn't say that. I don't have anything against the people, but I say we don't know them. We don't circulate like we used to do it.
Do you know when the years the foundry operated?
No.
Union Cities operated well for a few years, beginning I think around 1846, and old records say that Bog ore was hauled from Butler Township
along the river. We used to, over where we worked, you'd pull up chunks that big of regular iron, all would be rusty and that, but they made iron of it. And I understand it was a foundry out here in Tewksbury and in through there.
Right. It never got developed. They bought the equipment, had it, shipped in here. I read something about that. But somehow they went broke over a period of a couple of years. They didn't get it developed.
Well, it was pretty expensive ore, that is, to get enough to make a paying job, they just couldn't dig it up fast enough. It wasn't like you had a vein or anything, it was just scattered around it like stone.
Well, the veins just weren't large enough.
No, they wasn't close enough together. You can see it clear up through here to Girard and like that, you can see that dirt, it soil just as red as rust is what it looks like.
Okay, Alex Simpson is here. He lives in Jonesville now and retired from teaching in Fort Wayne, wasn't it? Not too long ago. And he used to live next door right here. So what do you remember about that?
We used to go to country school over here, too. We went to school together.
Did you?
That's a real
reunion.
My beginnings began around there in about 1911. My brother and I went to school here, and a little more at that time as our teacher. But if you didn't pass, that was a different story. I was lucky to pass. And while we're mentioning school, a few things about school that interest me, in fact, I was a teacher beginning way back in 1918, and with teaching and going to school, I stuck with it in 1962. 40 of those years was in Fort Wayne, Indiana, 37 of them in the same building, teaching 8th grade general science. Well, now, a few things about our schooling. We had a one-room school, and, of course, one teacher. And the teacher taught all eighth grades. Sometimes there were all of them, beginning with what we call the chart class. My first experience was over in Herricksville. I taught there 2 years. And we had, I think, 7 in the chart class. Well, you know, at the end of that first year, they could read. But I think they learned how to read in spite of me and not because of me. They were interesting to try to teach. I seem to be hoarse. Well, we had our, as was mentioned before, we had school programs, Christmas programs. Everybody was asked to take part and usually did. Of course, some were real actors and actresses, and some were like I was, scared to death. The mornings we'd frequently have singing. Our medley teacher would read a story to us, and we began about 9 o'clock in the morning and ran through to 4 o'clock in the afternoon. 8 or 9 months school, depending on the district, I believe. I thought it'd be interesting to talk about the way they used to live, what we did. Now, my experience was partly on the farm, but partly going to high school. So I'm not as qualified as some of you people might be to talk about farming. But we did a lot of it, just the same. Now and then, the spring work, we did such things as draw out manure, plow the fields, got ready to sow oats, and we had fences to repair and fences to build, and with plowing to do and harrowing to do. That was all horse work. No tractors in those days. We sowed oats in the spring, and in the fall we sowed wheat. And in the spring we planted corn, and we planted that by hand. I remember we had what we call a marker. You go across the field one way and across the other, and where the lines crossed, you planted your corn with a hand planter. And if you were a straight driver with a marker, you had a fairly decent-looking cornfield. Later, they commenced to use corn planters pulled by horses. And somebody originated an old gag about why was there more corn raised in crooked rows and in straight ones. Well, the answer was there were more crooked ones. Now the harvesting the corn, we usually started in the fall, cut by hand with a corn knife, and put in shocks, usually 8 hills square. If you're a really good corn cutter, you could cut 100 shock a day. The best I ever did was 65. But then later they got so the some of them had what they call sleds for cutting corn. You rode on a sled and had an old crosscut saw blade in one side and one in the other, and they were sharpened. And you went right between the rows and the two men on the sled, and you got your arm full of corn and stacked it up along your side. I never could do that. Some of us, you know, are a little more clumsy than others. I was one of the clumsy variety. The then later we commenced to have silos. I can remember Chip Moore had a silo built up in the Moore place right straight east here. I guess I'm pointing right. Yeah. And that was made with steel mesh, like lath. Went round and round, and was plastered on both sides with, I think, a concrete mixture. I don't remember too much about that, but I do remember a story of what happened once when they were filling it. Something went wrong with the tractor they were going to use, and they couldn't use it, but they'd been making... McAdam Road up east and west through here, and the engine was parked across the road somewhere, but somebody had stolen the governor. And one of the men said, well, I can run a steam engine even if it doesn't have a governor. So they did all right, and I don't know whether he got careless or what happened, but the thing got to going too fast, and the silo filler blew up, and parts of it went right through the silo. And there were a couple or three fellows in it, and you know, they used to think you had to tramp the ensilage. Well, they got stuck in the doorway trying to get out the same door. And after the pieces had all rained down around them, one of the men had a delayed shock, and he got both hands over his head and let a yell at him and took off across the cornfield. I guess it quite a day. No, maybe that's enough corn. Going to the haying, we had horse-drawn mowers, and we would cut the hay and would cure a while, and then we'd rake up with a dumper acre side delivery, and we'd put it in cocks and then pitch it onto the wagon, and the wagons would draw to the hay mow in the barn, and some places you still pitch it off by hand, other places they had we used slings and hay forks to dump in the hay mow. Then came alfalfa. And that was fun at first. I can remember where farmers thought they had to protect the alfalfa from the sun, so that when they'd make the haycock, they'd put little white covers put on it, like an overgrown baby's diaper, just put over the stock, over the little haycock, to cure it out. And then they thought they had to pitch it on the hay because they thought hay loaders would knock the leaves off. We've come a long ways from then. But oh, I think I ought to, before I forget it, talk about the women a while.
Wait a minute, Alex. If you're going to do that, I want to change records. For the women.
Women worked pretty hard back in those days. They had larger families as a rule, and they had to cook big meals, and they had usually a coal and wood range, and a range would have what they call a warming oven. Some of the things they could cook, they could set up in the warming oven to keep them hot or warm at least. But their big job, I think, was feeding threshers. Those threshers would come in, they'd wash the best they could, but they weren't always too clean. They'd sit around the table. I know my mother had a table, I think she said, would seat 18 or 19 people. A great big long, they could stretch out. And they had all kinds of stuff to eat. You name it, they had it. And the table manners were quite interesting. I remember one time at Rex Rossman's, they were thrashing, and Billy Cooper, I think it was, wanted the butter. And he was clear down one end of the table. One of the men had it up at the other end. He just took it like that. Through the whole length of the table. But Billy did all right. He caught it. One thing about the work back in those days, people helped one another. They were neighbors. If you got in trouble, first thing you knew, your neighbor's there to help you. I remember one time when after my dad went blind, of course that threw a lot of work on David. He had an 8-acre field of corn to cultivate, and we happened to look out, and here was somebody in the field cultivating it. And Steve Grosko that come down with his tractor and cultivator and cultivate his corn. And they're always doing things. They had plowing bees for people who were ill. We had potato digging bees. We had all kinds of bees and killing honeybees once in a while. But back to the women. They had a lot of canning to do. They canned everything, I think. Plums, peaches, cherries, all kinds of stuff. And they prided themselves on having a lot of cans down cellar. I remember once my mother counted up, she had 65, and that was small compared to some. And they had their laundry to do by hand, scrub boards, washboards, I guess they called them, and they would stand over them in the tub and back and forth. Oh, my aching back was a favorite song. The house cleaning was another big job. Usually if a man was smart, he kept out the way during house cleaning time. The women were the backbone of keeping track of socials and one thing or another. Without the women, we just couldn't have been here. And more ways than one. They had ladies' aides, and I think maybe sweet cider had been better.
Just wondering how he knows so much about the women's work. This is getting interesting.
You see, my mother was a woman. They'd have church socials, and we boys got roped in on that. We turned the 5-gallon freezer, and we usually got...
You licked the paddle.
We got to lick the paddle. And I remember once we worked awful hard, and the can of the freezer had sprung a leak, and had salt water in it, and we couldn't eat the ice cream. It all worked for nothing.
Sure did.
Now, the... some of the women are awfully good at making butter. My mother had me one of those. She usually worked it so well that when you looked at it, you couldn't see flecks of salt through it. If you could, she didn't think it was well done. And then they'd take the butter to town and sell it or trade it for groceries. And then they do the same thing with the eggs, too.
And that buttermilk was priceless.
Oh, yes. Now, the buttermilk... I don't like yogurt or anything of that sort, but I do like buttermilk. Some people say that's one of your idiosyncrasies. You should like both of them. But now, the women usually got to get the egg money. They did a lot of buying of the groceries and one thing or another with egg money. Maybe that should give the women a rest a while. Go to a little of the cutting of wood. I'm one of those peculiar individuals that always like to cut wood. I know when I'd be home weekends from high school, I'd be cutting wood. And when I was teaching, a friend of mine and I, one winter, we cut 22 cord of wood besides doing our teaching. Now, we used axes. A double-bitted axe for those who could handle them, and a single bit for those of us who couldn't. And we had cross-cut saws, 6 foot, 5 1/2. I don't know whether any longer than that around here or not. There were in other parts of the country. Then somebody got the idea of buzz saws. You'd cut the
6 foot
wooden pole lengths and then saw it up with a buzz saw. That was a lot faster and easier. And then, of course, the wood had to be drawn up in the house, and if a woman was lucky, she had a woodshed to store the wood in. If not, it stayed out of doors. And I can remember, north of us here, there was a couple of men, Jim Williams and Ross Palmer. They would draw wood. They'd cut good maple wood, draw it to Litchfield, and sell it for $1.50 a cord. And the best deal we ever got was we got wood from Glenn Burroughs one time. He cut up an orchard. We got 10 cord for $1.50 a cord. And Well, maybe I've talked enough.
I think you should tell them about your parents, where they came from, how you have become this country.
I don't know. You people have read about Belfast and how nice and kindly they are toward one another over there. They go all the way from shooting them with rifles and shotguns to blowing them up with bombs. Well, I came from Belfast, Ireland, way back in 1908. We had a... Of course, now this isn't Butler. We had a very interesting trip. We had a headwind all the way across. We got about a day out from Boston. We came there instead of New York because it was a shorter sea trip. Mother was sick all the time. We met a freighter that had gone on fire. They got the animals overboard as much as they could so they wouldn't burn up. One of the men went crazy and he climbed a mast, and the mast burned off at the bottom and dumped him right down in the midst of the fire. That was quite a day. And it was so stormy that our captain wouldn't order anyone overboard in a boat. He called for volunteers, and the whole crew volunteered, and half of the passengers to man the lifeboats. And the captain was burned blind. And when they were giving him up a rope ladder, he fell down between the lifeboat and the ship, but they managed to rescue him. Well, that's enough Ireland. But
when you were talking about schools, I noticed in this write-up by Emmett Locke, he mentions that in 1867, Ira Lampman was the winter school teacher who taught the boys in the winter at Daybird. And Jenny Du Bois was the summer school teacher who taught the girls in the summertime. And this may have been true at the first school, because it said that Charles Wisner in Shakespeare was the first teacher in the winter, and then there was another Hewitt, I think, was teacher for the summer.
Ernest? Why, our school down there, my dad, when he was a kid, or young man, they had 70 pupils in that room. And what it was is the boys worked on the farm, every one of them, in the summer. And then they all went to school in the winter. And they taught geometry and algebra and French and every darn thing down there. One of Ethel's, I guess be an uncle or great uncle, Dibble, was the teacher there. But they gave them a full college course in five or six months. Then I guess probably the girls come this summer, maybe that's what he said.
Some of the
but they had 70 in that little schoolroom.
Some of the schools had two entrances.
Set in the windows.
The boys would win one, the girls in the other.
Yeah.
Quick Center had that.
Yeah, and their dinner buckets were kept separate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think maybe I told enough. I could go on talking the rest of the afternoon, but I guess I'm better.
Roy Eldridge was the teacher down there.
I wanted to mention one more thing about the Masonic Hall, Masonic Grange Hall. It was built north of here a half mile. In 1893, the Grange sold the building for $200 to the Masons, and then they built a new hall right over here, just around the corner. And then, where's the rest of the story?
1907.
I've got it. They moved the Masonic Hall, which is down here, down to this location where it is now.
Same building.
Same building.
Same wall.
Yeah. Same building that was built on whatever it was.
One thing I'd like to mention was a little bit about our amusements. And I'll tell just one thing about that. A lot of us like to go hunting. And I can remember I started out using a single barrel shotgun. And there were five of us went one day. I should be able to mention names, but I can't think of them. And I didn't have a very good day. And Ira Smith was telling about it afterwards. He said Alec had 14 shots at rabbits, and the only one he got was a dead one I found the hole and gave to him. You know, that was literally true. The last one I shot at, I hadn't noticed I'd killed the rabbit, but Ira had noticed it. He reached in the hole and pulled him out and gave him to him. And that was the only one I got out of 14 shots. I'll never forget it.
Picking corn the other day and got down to 8-10 rows, and there was only 7 pheasants went out. Oh. Roosters. I know about population.
I talked with Letha Bates. Those of you who lived around here remember the James I. Bates family. Yeah. That lived just west of Masonic Hall, first house. And she said one thing that she remembered about their home there. I don't know what happened while she lived there previous to that, but it was originally a one-story house, and they added the second story on the western part, and that addition was ordered through Sears and Roebuck.
Oh, good.
I never heard of that. So.
You want to know about modern prices? My boy and I used to work Ed Rainey's farm over west of Hicksville. And we went in there, and where they couldn't get with horses, we had a big tractor with 24-inch wheels. And we went in and cut virgin timber, brought it home, and sawed it. We had a sawmill sitting over here. And we drawed it to Coldwater for $26 a thousand. Now it'll cost you $26 a plank.
I'd like to mention just briefly South Butler Store, which used to be right here at the end of the road, just beyond the schoolhouse across the road where I grew up. In 1888, Charles Williams sold a small piece of land to Sarah Ann Smith, and she built this house. The house was a house and store combination. And in 1893, Clarence Hayes, who was related and lived with the Smiths, operated the store for a while. He bought an adjoining piece of property, which he willed to Mrs. Smith when he died, so that made about a 1-acre site down there. And in 1915, before my mother was married, she purchased South Butler's store from Sarah A. Smith. And then when she and my father were married, they moved to Chicago in 1919, and then until 1923, about a 4-year period, some other people operated the store. Whaley's, and who else was telling you? Somebody else.
Donovan and Mildred Way, my sister.
Way. And did you say Houck's? Somebody, did you say Houck's?
Dwayne Houck.
Yeah. Sometime in the, during that period. And then my parents, I think, came back in about 1923. This is a jar of baking powder that we used to sell in the store, has my dad's name on the back of it, G.C. Wilkinson, South Butler, Michigan. And this is a can that used to be in the store, had tea, and when we didn't sell much tea by bulk, well, I sold pepper and I don't know what all it were contained in those particular tin cans. And this happens to be, somebody was asking about a blacksmith shop in this area, and just a half mile east where my folks bought a farm and lived after they left the store, there used to be a blacksmith shop. And when they moved it, when they lived there and moved blacksmith back from the road, this was underneath the floor. Maybe it was a wine bottle or something. I don't know what it was. But anyway, this was found there at that time. And I do have one other item here I want to mention. I probably not many of you know my father, but he didn't. He never said too much, but this is a medal that he won here in this building when it was a church as a, in an oratorical contest about the year 1900 that was sponsored by the WCTU.
I knew him. Sharpie.
Homer?
Church key.
Oh, yeah. This is the church key that was the key for this building. It always hung down in the store whenever anybody needed to get into the church. This was the church key for the old doors in the church. Homer?
Well, I have a few items here, or a few things to mention to bring up. Most of it's on the moors and a little on the township. The history that I have gathered, as June said, there's a section over in Schwicks Prairie was was the prairie with some oak trees in it. And the first stone house in any all the history I can get is the stone house that Tom Oxenhand grew up in and is still over there now. Is that right, Tom?
That's right. Now, George Lockwood was my great-grandfather, and he's the one who built it. He was in our family in two host years until it was sold to the Van Orke family for a period of time, before back.
And I was talking to Clark Van Orke, and a few years back, I don't know, he told me how far, but I kind of forgot. But they re-chipped all the mortar around the stones and put in cement, because it was put in with sand and lime mortar.
And over the period of years, the limestone was out, and this caused nothing but sand in the walls. So we still have problems, even today, people that own the house have the same problem. At night, when it's real quiet in the house, when wind's blowing or something, you can hear the sand trickling down in the wall.
Help yourself.
Why, our schoolhouse was made that way. See, there's more schools right west of me. And that, the whole wall tipped out around the window. And they brought the masons out. That was after it was consolidated. See, they were still using it. And I went down and I told them if they would, or the masons, why $1,500 put it back. And I told them if they'd give me a title to the land and the school, they could use it just as long as they'd want to, and I'd build it. See, I put the M back in. Well, to guess what kind of a thing, it took 19 yards of gravel plus the cement to lay those same walls back, and I laid them up there. But you could get up and the whole thing would just tip right out, and as he said, the sand. It was setting in sand. No, lime had all lost it.
And these walls, the stones on the outside are cut on five sides, four sides in front.
Yeah.
And of course, the stones vary in size, that's why the walls had to be 2 foot thick, and they were filled in behind with leftover broken pieces. And then the beams were stuck right into the wall that held floors, and the.
The diarrhea that we had done, back up a little more. Down here at the store was the post office at that time. And Irene lived, and the McDonald lived a mile and a half north here on the Burbank Road. At the present time, if you, anybody knows where Jerry Whitney lived, it was right across the road in a little house there. Well, anyway, her mother made her a oilcloth knapsack, and it was her job to come down here to the store and pick up all the mail and deliver it up the Burbank Road, up as far as she lived. And she thought that was great stuff as a kid to deliver the mail. But later years, her father was a rural carrier out of Quincy, and I remember him delivering mail.
Maria says he drove a horse and buggy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Horse and buggy? That part I don't remember. But around the corner up there was his brother, and I do remember he'd always take time on a nice sunshiny day to stop and throw horseshoes with his brother a little while on the mail route.
Yeah.
Now, Dayburg over here, I think you brought that up, was named after the Day family. Well, the Dayburg got its name over here. It's about the third house, west of the Dayburg Church. It was the Day family and the Day farm. And that's how the area got that name. And Ernest mentioned about the foundry over here along Hog Creek, and it was on the old Whitmore farm.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, just this side of Hog Creek up on top of the hill. And also, Butler, it's unknown to most people, but my father said that they drilled a well up here on Briar Hill and had it drilled, and when they went down in there, I don't know how far, but they went through a layer of coal about 12 foot deep in there. So Butler's got a coal mine. Well, nobody knows it.
There's another one right over on the Dean Road at the county line. They drilled an oil well, and they got 8 foot of nice coal you ever see. But the down 200 or 300 feet.
Now, my grandfather was B.O. Moore, Bradley O. Moore, and he was I would say, as the story was passed down to me, very aggressive and trying new things. And at the time, alfalfa was just coming into the picture. He took and hauled some marl from down the road on another 40 acres of ours, and he spread it by hand. And he planted 5 acres in it of alfalfa, and it was a novelty for the neighborhood to see this new kind of grass grow. There's no way around here to ever see it. Now, the year that was, I do not know. And he also, in clearing this property across the road here, north of the building, in the sag, and there was about 75 rods there. There used to be a river up through there. Well, he didn't want that river in his field, so he went to a blacksmith, and he had 2 forms made for a tile, 2 foot in diameter, and they're about 4 foot long. I still have the forms. And he made the cement tile for about 75 rods, and then he dug the trench and laid them. And actually, they're working today. I hope they always work as long as I have to work the land, because I don't know what I'd do if they don't.
That's the upper end of the county drain, isn't it?
Right.
It runs right across the road.
And also, my grandfather, him and another man that came here from New York back in before the Civil War, they decided to go up northern Michigan and trap and for the winter, and to make themselves some money. So they went up there, and they got up there, and they discovered they were going to run out of provisions, so they left everything, their traps, their deadfalls, and all they'd made, and started back walking down. And he was walking through the forest and didn't know there was a man within 100 miles from him, and all at once he walked past a tree, and he heard somebody said, "Give me a match." And he turned around and looked, and there stood an Indian. This Knowles Mill down here was mentioned by June or somebody here, and there's a little, and I've heard my father say that when he went down there, this Knowles, like, over the dam, the spillover, he always had a fish trap, so that's the way he caught all of his fish. Anytime he wanted fish, he'd go out, pick one out of this little crate where the fish would fall in the trap over the dam. And he also told me that that's why this Burbank Road ends here. It lines up actually with the road right north of Quincy, but they had to detour around on account of the Knowles mill pond. That's why the Clarendon Road don't go straight through. And then there was an Indian trail. I have a map here. Now this map, all these red, this is actually Branch County. I had to sign my death certificate to get it out of the Coldwater Library. But this corner here is Butler Township. And on this map it shows 2 Indian trails over in the northwest quarter of the township. But my grandfather said that there was an Indian trail just north of our buildings down here. It went right east and west through here, but it doesn't show it on this map. And then down here, about 3/4 mile, there was a wigwam. Now, in that case over there, there's a bunch of Indian arrows, stones and so on, and all those were found on our property across the road, and there was a guy there just the other day, in fact picked our stove, and he was apparently a little sharp on Indian relics. And he said, this was a skinning knife. Well, it was new to me, but he said that was sharp, but it still won't cut my finger.
Yeah, not a sharp one.
But that's what they skinned their animals with. And this, I suppose, was a tomahawk where they beamed somebody over the head. And then this is one of the arrows. You've all seen them. But in the early days, there was a bunch of elk in this area. Because when my grandfather cleared the 40 acres down near a half mile and 80 rods to the left, it was covered with elk horns. So apparently there was a lot of elk in this area. And then the property across the road was 80 acres that my grandfather bought, and he bought it on a contract before the Civil War, just before. And then he went to the Civil War and came back, and then he got the deed of it in 1865, I think, or 4. But then he cleared it. He stayed over in Trix Prairie, and I did know the name of the family, but I didn't write that stuff down. Now it's gone. But anyway, he'd walked back and forth over from Trix Prairie over here and cleared the 80 acres. And I've been told everything north of the buildings here was all hard maple. And one night one day he come over to clear, and he left his jacket, and he walked back at night. He would come before daylight and go back after dark. And in his pocket of his jacket, he had $40, which then days, I suppose, was a lot of money. And he didn't dare to leave it all night, so he makes another trip back from Schrutz Prairie after dark to get his jacket.
Be 4 miles, wouldn't it, five?
Anyway, that.
4 or 5 miles.
So, and then he also, I just throw this one in. You probably heard up north of Lansing there was a little town by the name of Edmore. That was named after my grandfather's brother that settled there. And the Dwight Burbank place up here that June mentioned, the 40 acres on the east side of the road, I have here that the taxes on it was 85 cents.
1852.
Well, a little cheaper than it is now. And then somebody mentioned about the schoolhouse here. The first schoolhouse was told to me. It was setting right between this building here and our other house right over here. It used to be the parsonage. That was where the original school was. And on our property across the road, there have been 3 houses on it now. The first house sat in our barn drive, and it was before I remember. I remember the house being moved as a tool house then, a portion of it. Then the second house is where the third one is here now that burnt in 38. And we rebuilt the one we have now. But back in 1936, I see Mary holding up the tag. It was the first we had electricity out here in the Moondocks.
Well,
I guess that about catches up on the moor end.
Anybody have any last bits of wisdom they want
to? I have one item here, though. I haven't read it, though, so I can't give you much on it. But my grandmother, or in other words, my great-grandfather was in the Civil War, and that's Revolutionary War, misspoke. And he was buried in Wick Center Cemetery. And in, well, I can't catch the date here, but... In 21. Anyway, the DAR discovered that, and then my grandmother... more. They had a little ceremony over there, and my grandmother unveiled the marker for the revolutionary soldier. So I guess that's it.
way. My granddad was in the Civil War, and he had a brother. His name was Gilbert, and he was in what they called the engineers. He didn't carry a gun. He carried hammers and axes and built bridges right when he was marching to get into the country. And they saw some real rugged life, if you ever heard of. And so they did have times in your Civil War time.
Well, that little brochure that Homer has on Eli Ball, the revolutionary soldier, he joined when he was just prior to being 16 years of age. He lived in Massachusetts then. And he got bitten by a rattlesnake while they were marching. And they didn't have time to stop, so he just took his knife and cut out the spot where it was bitten and wrapped, put salt on it from his eating materials that he had, wrapped his hanky around it, and ran on down the trail.
Yeah.
The Well, I think that...
That's pretty well, Butler.
I think that pretty well winds us up, and thank everybody for taking part, and we'll turn back to whoever wants it.
All right.